Well, this is Elizabeth Crow, and facilitating the call today. Thanks to all who are joining us. We may have a few more people joining the call after we start, but I'd like to be respectful of everyone's time and go ahead and get started. You might have just heard an announcement, but if not, the call this morning is being recorded, and that recording will be available on the Coming Clean website following our call today, if you need it for your reference. So hello, and welcome to the teleconference call. My name is Elizabeth Crow, and I'm the Associate Director of the Coming Clean Collaborative. Today, my colleagues and I are presenting a new peer-reviewed article published today in the journal Environmental Health called Air Concentrations of Volatile Compounds Near Oil and Gas Production, a Community-Based Exploratory Study. We're also presenting a companion report titled Warning Signs, Toxic Air Pollution at Oil and Gas Development Sites. It was written by Coming Clean and Global Community Monitor. Both the article and the report can be found at www.comingcleaninc.org/warning signs and at www.gcmonitor.org. And as I just mentioned, this call is being recorded for audio, and we'll have that posted on the Coming Clean site after the call as well. If I can just issue a reminder to folks who are on the call, if you could please mute your lines until you're speaking, either for presenters when it's your turn to speak, or for reporters, we'll have Q&A after the presentations. That'll just help us keep down the background noise. I am pleased to be facilitating the call today where we'll be presenting stark results from the community-based air monitoring near oil and gas development sites, including fracking sites, in six states: Arkansas, Colorado, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and Wyoming. Coming Clean is a national environmental health and justice collaborative, and we're focused on reform of the petrochemical industry so that it is no longer a source of harm. We partnered with 12 local groups in these states and with Global Community Monitor to conduct air sampling in places where people felt their health is being impacted from oil and gas development. We know that the impacts from oil and gas development are part of a larger cycle of chemical contamination involving nearly every community and household in the U.S. And we believe that by identifying and acknowledging this contamination, we can focus together on how to protect families, workers, and our communities. For this project, we also partnered with health and medical professionals, small business groups, and environmental protection groups all over the country to review the results and help lift up the voices from people living in these impacted communities who have stories that need to be heard and who have recommendations on how to fix the problems that we face. So later on, we're going to hear about those recommendations from Ruth Breach, who's the program director with our lead partner group on this project, Global Community Monitor. Other speakers today include Rebecca Roeder, a study participant from Breathe Easy Susquehanna County in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, who will talk about the toxic air in her community near oil and gas development. And we'll also hear from Deb Thomas, who's from Clark, Wyoming, and with the group Shale Test, who will describe how people living near oil and gas development sites in Wyoming are experiencing poor health. We'll also listen to the experiences of Emily Lane with ArkansasFracking.org, who will describe the health and economic and property issues facing her community as a result of oil and gas development. Dr. David Carpenter is a lead author of the article appearing today in Environmental Health, and a longtime physician who's been engaged in addressing environmental toxic health impacts. He's going to discuss the health problems that are linked to oil and gas development and the toxic chemicals emitting from those sites. And other article co-authors and experts and community members are also available listening to this call and will be available at the bottom of the hour when we bring the reporter questions and answers. But first, Denny Larson, who's the Executive Director of Global Community Monitor, is going to give a short summary of the air monitoring findings. Denny, why don't you go ahead and and tell us what the study findings were.
Sure. Thank you, Elizabeth, and welcome everybody to our media conference. My name again is Danny Larson. I'm the Executive Director of the Global Community Monitor. We're a nonprofit organization that trains and empowers communities to monitor their environment for themselves and help to transform their communities to truly sustainable neighborhoods. The six-day study, including New York, really was coming out of trying to answer some very simple questions from people living near the flood of new oil and gas development. And that was, what are we breathing? Very simple question. We used, of course, the protocols that we have developed over the years together with the US EPA and various other state agencies to ensure very credible sampling of air around these oil and gas development sites. Our systems are very replicable. We have now worked in 29 different countries with more than 100 partner groups. Had many successes along the way, including billions of dollars spent by facilities to clean up, in some cases relocate their neighbors, or make policy changes at the local, state, and federal government level. In our study, we found 8 chemicals in excess of US EPA's most hazardous cancer risk level. About 40% of the samples had concentrations of volatile organic compounds, toxins, above these federal standards. The chemicals that exceeded the health and safety standards most often, the chemical was formaldehyde, a known human carcinogen, as well as hydrogen sulfide, a nerve gas toxin, blown by its rotten egg odor. 7 samples also contained hydrogen sulfide in concentrations ranging from 2 times the safe level to 660 times above the level classified by the US EPA as immediately dangerous to life and health. 14 samples, 7 from the state of Arkansas and 6 from Pennsylvania, 1 from Wyoming, contained concentrations of formaldehyde that exceeded EPA's most hazardous cancer risk level. Several other chemicals of concern, including benzene, the known human carcinogen, as well as hexane, toluene, xylene, which are nerve toxins, were detected in various states with concentrations above health and safety standards. 1 sample in Wyoming contained hexane at 7,000 times at the Agency for Toxic Substance Disease Registry's level for non-cancer risk. So indeed, the numbers that we across the board found near these sites are alarming. They are, as our title of a report clearly states, a warning sign. I also want to take a moment to thank the dozens and dozens of volunteers who were the people power of this project. This project was largely an all-volunteer project for the citizens and community members who were taking samples by their homes, at their ranches, at their goat farm, in a variety of public and private property places. Thousands of hours were spent by those volunteers in training, conducting the samples, taking the samples, ensuring their quality control, quality assurance methods, chain of custody, and rigorous controls were observed. So I want to thank those volunteers for their thousands of hours of service in the project. What we are leading toward with this project is building a movement of community scientists who are partnered with academics, medical professionals, nurses, people from all walks of life, in order to reform the oil and gas industry, which by the numbers needs serious reform. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Denny. Again, Denny Larson, the Executive Director of Global Community Monitor. Welcome to those of you who have just recently joined the call. I'm Elizabeth Crow, and I'm facilitating the call today. And just a reminder, if you haven't already done so, if you could mute your line until you speak. We will go through our set of presenters today and then have time for Q&A for reporters at the end of the call. It's now my honor to introduce Dr. David Carpenter, who's the director of the Institute for Health and Environment at the University at Albany, State University of New York, and who is a lead author on the journal article appearing today in Environmental Health. Dr. Carpenter, could you please share with us what the health concerns are from the toxic chemicals identified in this study?
Yes, thank you. I certainly will be happy to. I think Denny has already given some indication of the specific chemicals that we found the elevated. And let me start with cancer. Everybody understands how bad cancer is. And two of the compounds we found in the air at extraordinary concentrations around some of the sites, not all of them, but a goodly number, were benzene, which has long been known to be a human carcinogen, especially causing liver cancer and leukemia, and formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is basically an embalming fluid, and it is harmful to the body, and it is well known to be a carcinogen. If you remember the FEMA trailers, that was formaldehyde, and the government took rigorous action to reduce exposures there. Now, one thing about cancer is that it doesn't happen tomorrow after your exposure. Cancer usually takes at least 5 and more often 10 or 20 or even 30 years to develop. So our concern is that these carcinogens were monitored near homes, near schools, near farms with animals, and the people that are exposed are going to be at risk of developing cancer, but it will only appear in the future. And therefore, it's hard to point to individuals that have developed cancer because of the fracking wells at this point. But they're very dangerous. Then he mentioned hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is the smell of rotten eggs, and you can smell it often around sewage treatment plants and places like that. Hydrogen sulfide is not known to be a carcinogen, but it is very irritating to the eyes, to the throat, and it decreases the quality of life. Hydrogen sulfide and the volatile organics, which are a great number of them, and Denny's mentioned several specific ones, they also act on the brain, and they create what many people describe as brain fog. You have headaches, you can't think as well. It just reduces your ability to perform in an optimal fashion. So this is a more difficult thing to quantitate, but these are real symptoms that the people living near these well sites and compressor stations that we monitor, these are the symptoms that these people report. Now, there were a number of elevations of this whole group of volatile organic compounds. And in our study, we measured a lot of them. The one in greatest concentration is methane. That's the major component of natural gas. Methane by itself is not terribly toxic, but in high concentrations, it does have these effects on the brain and behavior. It's ridiculous that there's so much leaking from these sites. If the technology were done in a fashion that did not allow these chemicals to leach, we would not have the problem that we have. Now, let's go back and talk a little about formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is formed in some two fashions. And I tell you, the highest concentrations of formaldehyde were usually around compressor stations, where a lot of natural gas is formed. And formaldehyde is formed by combustion. But formaldehyde is also like ozone. It's formed when volatile organics, in this case methane, is acted on by sunlight. So the formaldehyde is a reflection both of the combustion of methane, but also of the leak of methane. Our recommendations are, first, we must apply the same rule to the oil and gas industry that apply to every other industry. They have been exempted by the U.S. Congress from regulations under the Clean Air Act, and therefore they basically are not regulated except by states. These compounds are dangerous compounds. They're adversely affecting the health of people that live nearby, and that is simply not acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Again, that was Dr. David Carpenter, who's the director of the Institute for Health and Environment at the University at Albany, State University of New York. Appreciate your words. Here's next to describe some of the impacts of oil and gas development in Arkansas is Emily Lane from ArkansasFracking.org. Emily lives in Greenbrier, Arkansas. And right now, she's speaking to us from an airport, so we beg your pardon for any background noise. Thank you so much for joining us, Emily. Could you please describe some of the changes you have observed and felt in your community since this oil and gas development boom has really hit central Arkansas?
Thank you, Elizabeth. I appreciate this call. I appreciate all the press who are on here today, because there certainly are a lot of people suffering a variety of issues in the Fayetteville Show, and I'll just talk about it to do a bit. So we start out with things like nuisances like bright lights, loud noises, heavy truck traffic, things that keep you up at night, things that keep you from getting a good night's sleep and in constant states of stress. And of course, these nuisances turn into more terrible issues like contaminated water wells, foul air, strange chemical smells, loss of sense of peace, and of course, in a lot of cases, because mineral rights, received property rights in Arkansas, many people have drilling forced upon them on their land, or upstream, or upwind from their land. I myself have experienced many problems just from working inside the Fayetteville Shale, going to talk to residents, or going to take an air sample. The very first time I went to the Fayetteville Shale to interview a resident, I had an allergy attack and could not stop sneezing for about half an hour. I had to remove myself from the area. A few months later, I visited another home in a rural area, and I'll say that this whole area of the Fayetteville Shale is very rural, a lot of cattle farms. So the second time I went to visit this one couple in particular, I had my first nosebleed. Never had that issue before, and I've had this issue a few times since then after visiting the Fayetteville Shale. I've met several residents in the past few years after doing this work. One woman in particular, named Tracy, she moved to the area in about 2000, and she moved to the area because it was peaceful, it was safe, and she wanted to set up her sanctuary for her animals. She rehabilitates exotic cats, exotic animals from around the world, and keeps them in this safe place so they can go back into the wild or go into other captivity. In 2008, the drilling came in, and by 2010, she was surrounded by about 36 well pads with various levels of activity. Right away, she started seeing symptoms in her cats and her other animals, like lesions, hair loss, low fertility rate, stillborn animals. The ones that did survive, many of them had severe birth defects. Within just a few months, her and her husband as well started experiencing some of these problems. They would have migraines that would last a week long. She would text me in the middle of the night how she just couldn't hardly stand it anymore. They would have issues with hair loss, of course, nausea, dizziness, rashes and lesions. She had moments where she would want to walk out her front door, sit on a porch, get some fresh air, but as soon as she walked out, she would be hit with this chemical smell. And it would give her an instant rash or an instant boil, and she'd have to go back inside. This poor woman was at home 24 hours a day for the most part, taking care of these animals and trying to rehabilitate them. So she was being exposed quite constantly. And she even had an instance where she passed out in her home, fell down her stairs, and broke her ankle. This was 2 years ago. She still is going through physical therapy. She's had multiple surgeries. She just will not heal. And same thing with all of her animals who have been affected. It's gone to the vet, of course, and the vet has no idea what's going on until a few of her cats died. And she hooked up with a toxicologist from Cornell University to do some necropsies on her animals. One in particular had chemical exposure damage in every single organ in the body of this one animal. So there is certainly definitely a link between chemical exposure and death of these animals. And, of course, this sanctuary that she set up is no longer a sanctuary. It's no longer a safe place. She's had to move all of her facilities and has taken tens of thousands of dollars of loss on this. This was the only facility of its kind in the state, so now the state is hurting. Any other of these animals have to go to other areas of the country to be rehabilitated, and there are very few of these facilities that exist around the world, so it really was a hit to these particular species, many of them endangered species, and they no longer have her site in Arkansas as a refuge. There are so many more stories I could tell, and I really hope that somebody contact me after this call. I'll hand this back over to Elizabeth, but I just want to say one last thing, and that this is a human rights and civil rights issue. There are so many people who have had the basic rights to breathe clean air and have peace of mind and have a nice quality of life, and many people I've talked to over the last few years in my work they feel like their lives are being taken away from them. They felt forced into the situation and absolutely no recourse or response from our state. And so, of course, this is why community members like me and some of my colleagues and volunteers and efforts do what we do, because we see this great need. So, again, we really appreciate the study and everyone on the call today. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Emily, for sharing those really painful stories, so important for us to hear. That's Emily Lane, who is a study participant and a community member from Central Arkansas with the organization ArkansasFracking.org. Next, I'd like us to hear from Deb Thomas, who's from Clark, Wyoming, which is a community experiencing oil and gas development for the last 40 years or so. In the air monitoring conducted by Deb and other trained community leaders there, showed some of the highest levels of toxic chemicals among all the areas where monitoring took place through this project. Deb, you've been working a long time with community members living near oil and gas development sites, and I wonder if you could share with us some of the health problems and other issues that folks are experiencing there.
I'm happy to. Thank you, Elizabeth. And I'd like to thank everyone on this call. It's so important that you're all participating and taking a good hard look at what's happening around this development. As Elizabeth said, I've been working on these issues since 1999 when oil and gas moved in across the road from our home. And interestingly, I not only work in Clark, where I live, but I also live in other areas or work in other areas in Wyoming, the Pavilion area, the Bighorn Basin and Wind River Basins around Deaver, Wyoming, which is in Park County of Wyoming. Interestingly, what we're seeing is the same kinds of health issues everywhere people are living with the development, both from the people who have development on their property, near their property, or who are working around the development. Everything from headaches, rashes, loss of smell and taste, nosebleeds, nose polyps, unexplained eye and ear infections, lots of kidney and urinary tract problems, neuropathy, muscle pain and pain in their extremities, a high incidence of miscarriage in both people and livestock, unusual cancers. Also, what Dr. Carpenter spoke to, the loss of cognitive skills. People can't seem to find their words. People who are very eloquent and very active can't form their thoughts into words any longer. We became involved in this project because people that I represent and that I've worked with over the last 15 years are sick. They started to recognize that this could be from what the development they're living around and working around, and they wanted to know what their exposures are. They need the information not only for their health providers, but so they can make some decisions about how they're going to protect themselves. If they want to stay in these areas, if they want to move their families out, they need the information. They deserve the information. We asked the state of Wyoming for years to address the issues that we suspected were arising from the emissions. And we didn't get much response. Wyoming officials continue to say that we have some of the cleanest air in the country, and that may be true in areas where development isn't taking place, but in the areas where there is heavy development, and that's widespread across Wyoming, the air quality is not good. The numbers from this study show that. We continually hear about the economic benefits of this industry. When you live in a state that is dependent on that economy, nobody wants to kill that golden goose. But what we don't hear about and what no one will address is what it's going to cost to clean up this mess, both to the environment and to the people's health who are living with this and working in it. The truth is that industry and the state are who are making all the money from this. The people who live with it don't. They don't get the benefits. They suffer the negative consequences of this industry. They're left holding the bag. And, you know, we can have a debate all day about fracking and this development, what fracturing of the rock thousands of feet underneath the ground is doing. But I can tell you one thing. We did all of the testing around production sites in Wyoming. Some of this development as old as 20, 30 years old. And no matter what fracking is actually doing right now, I can tell you that it's increasing development all across this country. And so what you're going to see is you're going to see more impacted communities, more health impacts, more people sick from this. And 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the road, you're going to be seeing what happens when this infrastructure starts to fail and people have not only acute exposures from the incidents that occur ongoingly and also from the chronic exposures they're getting as this all falls apart. So, again, thank you so much for looking at these issues. And if I can answer any questions, I'm happy to.
Thank you so much, Deb. Again, it was Deb Thomas from Clark, Wyoming, who serves as the executive director of the organization Shale Test and who was an active participant in monitoring her community for this study. And next we have Rebecca Roeder from Breathe Easy, Susquehanna County in Pennsylvania. Rebecca, I was wondering if you could tell us about the toxic emissions from oil and gas development in your community and what, you know, what the impacts are to local residents, and what responses to the issues that you're facing, you're getting or not, from people who have the power to make decisions on this development there.
Thank you very much for everybody being on the call and to be part of this project was such an opportunity that we were looking for data and science because Denny's opening remarks about wanting to know what we're breathing, you know, that is exactly our situation in a nutshell because you can look at the only data that we had prior to this really would be air quality permits for natural gas compressors from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. And formaldehyde is permitted in those emissions. So compressors, because we have 38 of them right now permitted in our county, were our major concern. But we have flares, we have more power plants on the books to be built, and there are going to be more emissions from that. We also have, I believe it's Gulf, is interested in coming into our rural county and having an LNG processing and storage facility. So it's just the beginning. We are only 7 years into the development of a sweet spot of the Marcellus. I live in a gas field here, and I have a compressor less than a mile from my house. And I myself have started to have chronic sinus infections again. I moved here in 1986 in part because I knew I had pollution allergies. And I had no issues with sinus infections until the development around me. And my doctor, when I went to see him for the third sinus infection this past spring, I asked him, do you think that the emissions from the compressor station could have anything to do with my sinus infections? And he looked at me and said, of course, just move. I would point out that the hospital was built by Cadet Oil and Gas. I asked my physician to note in my chart that I suspected the emissions from the Williams Central Station, less than a mile from my home, might have something to do with my third sinus infection in 4 months. And I don't think he wrote it in my chart. So the problems are not just about documenting and getting the data, but it's about transparency, which we don't have here. But getting the data is key because that gives us the teeth to try to change the dialogue. I'm not the only person with sinus infections. There are also three other compressors I'm aware of with people ranging from 17 to 79 years of age who've had problems with violent nosebleeds, some of them having to be transported by ambulance to the hospital, and they never had nosebleeds prior to that. And that is why we chose formaldehyde badges and we positioned them close to some of these compressor stations where we knew families were experiencing nosebleeds. There's also a family where they have a compressor, they have probably four well pads around them, an impoundment, and one of their members is experiencing decreased respiratory function. So the problems are very real. And the data is what we need to get our legislators to pay attention. And what we really would like to do is have fence line monitoring. We're hoping that getting data like what was generated in this project will get the attention of our community officials and our legislators and drive the dialogue so that we can limit our chemical exposure and advocate for our families' health. And again, transparency is needed. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. Again, that's Rebecca Roeder from Breed Easy, Susquehanna County in Pennsylvania. And Rebecca began, you know, really kind of talking about what we do recommend and what communities really need. Moving away, telling people they have to move away from an area or people feeling as though they have to move away, even if they could, is not a solution to this problem. The problem that Deb is describing in Wyoming and kind of the crystal ball into experiences that other communities may be facing, denying that eventuality is not a solution. So now we're going to hear from Ruth Breach, who's the program director with Global Community Monitor. Ruth, a great diversity of community members and organizations involved in this study worked together to create a specific set of recommendations, not just to say what's wrong with the problem we're facing now with oil and gas development, but really look at how we could remedy the issue of toxics in the air near these development sites. Please share with us what these recommendations are.
Great. Thanks so much, Elizabeth, and thanks so much to everyone for being on the call this morning. You know, what I wanted to touch on today was this national scope of what's happening here. You know, here we have five communities, you know, six including New York, that were involved in this project. But we were also contacted by residents in West Virginia, Texas, North Dakota, and California. So this is happening nationwide in its scope. And while the geological formations may be different in each area, what we're seeing is this common thread of classic chemical exposure, and you've heard that from Emily and Deb and Rachel now, and Rebecca, I'm sorry, but they're happening all around the country. And what we really need to address is how this industry is embedded into the fabric of the community. The proximity of where people are living close to this industry, we literally having wells, compressor stations, condensate tanks, holding ponds, waste ponds, that are right behind somebody's home or on their farm or literally next to a park or a community center. So that's some of the things that you need to just be thinking of, that this is not limited to these specific communities that are in this study. And now the having really true hard data showing that these are not just anecdotal stories, this is actual chemical exposure happening in these neighborhoods, in these homes, and there's chemicals in the air. One of the things that we found through the breadth of this study and in many of our other projects that have been happening is that there's just not enough air monitoring going on at these sites. So one of our first recommendations coming out of this that we could all agree on in a national scope, as different groups in the local areas have specific recommendations for their local areas, but we all agreed on these things here, was that was air monitoring for toxic gases. We've touched on volatile organic compounds, hydrogen sulfide. These are chemicals that are classically coming from this industry, and we have little to no data by the state regulators about this industry, what is being emitted to the air, how much, how often, and how that could be exposing these nearby residential neighbors. So we need increased monitoring, and we also need increased enforcement by the state regulators of fracking and gas operations. Another crucial component of this industry is the lack of information. This is commonly known as community right to know. So myself, I'm based here in Richmond, California. I have more information about the Chevron oil refinery 4 miles from my home than a community member in Wyoming may have about the gas well that is literally feet from their home. So this includes disclosure of all chemicals that is being stored, emitted, and any constituents that are and compounds that are going in the fracking and the drilling. This includes a local emergency planning commissions, and then also emergency responders and medical professionals. So if somebody is exposed to these chemicals, we need to know what those chemicals are so that people can be treated appropriately, as well as workers and animals. We also need to consider that this industry is already happening. We're already in the middle of the boom, and that people are already being exposed. So anything forward should be encouraged to use the precautionary approach. Instead of exposing people first and finding out later, we need to find out if these chemicals are safe to be put into the environment before they can go out and be exposed to public health. We need to make public health a top priority, especially given the proximity of this industry to these communities. What we're seeing now, and Colorado is a great example of this, is that when the utilities and the government start to invest in things like green completion or emissions reduction, increases in efficiency, we know that this industry can do better. It can voluntarily make decisions to put in clean equipment, to do proper maintenance, and reduce emissions, and then possibly increase their profits by losing less chemicals out the door and exposing less people to those chemicals by simple maintenance. And this would include both the companies and then also the overseeing permitting regulatory agencies. And then the last piece I just wanted to touch on, that, again, given the proximity and the close proximity of this industry to its closest residential neighbors, and that many of these sites are actually on people's land, is that residents should be directly involved in the decision-making of each stage of extraction in the production cycle. Instead of, signing agreements or pushing people out of the way or pushing people out of their homes or off their land, residents should be involved in a community setting to be involved in that decision-making process. And then I just wanted to close that really, again, what we're seeing here is that this is a national epidemic. This is at a level that this is at a health crisis, that this industry is affecting so many people, and it is transforming so many communities from rural, suburban, and they're transforming them into industrial settings. And it's time that this industry is brought in, and we need to put the proper regulation, enforcement, air monitoring, make public health a top priority, and be inclusive to the people that this is directly impacting and affecting, and it's time for change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth, for describing what we're really looking forward to, and that is the real immediate needs for relief in local communities that are impacted, as well as the longer-term solutions that we need to deploy and continue to deploy now, including safer chemicals, and clean energy. So what we'd like to do now is open up for our Q&A from reporters. We do have, in addition to the speakers you've heard from already, a few other community members sustainable business experts who are on the phone, so I may call on them as well to answer any questions that you have. And just a reminder that we do have will have a recording of this teleconference available for your reference after it's finished. We'll post it up along with the report, a summary of the report, the Environmental Health Journal article, and also information on where you can contact each of the participant groups in this study up at comingcleaninc.org/warningsigns. So again, inviting reporters to ask questions. When you do ask a question, if you could please tell us your name and the name of your media organization, that would be very helpful. Please go ahead.
Hi, I have a question. I'm a reporter based in New York City. My name is Sarah Cree, and I write for the Gotham Gazette. Is the federal government, or can you kind of update us on what, if anything, the federal government is doing relative to public health concerns about hydraulic fracturing? And can you offer any clarification on, you know, the analysis that the EPA was doing relative to water contamination? But, I mean, especially with all the what you've raised about air quality, is the federal government looking at this at all?
Thanks for the question. This is Elizabeth. I think we can get back to you with some specific details on what rules and standards EPA is considering right now. As to the question about water, there are some organizations who are online who have done some extensive looking at water contamination from the sites, even though that wasn't involved in our study. I wonder, Deb or Rebecca, if you would have anything to say about that quickly.
Well, this is Rebecca, and I would say that my Department of Environmental Protection has not had great media over the past couple of months. Most recently, a couple of weeks ago, a former air expert noted that DEP had used incomplete data and incorrect and inaccurate data in reporting emissions, short-term study emissions from Marcellus sites. The same thing happened with water, you know, how they investigated suspected water impacts. They had sweet codes that withheld information and also didn't test for key things that should have been tested for. Something that's a glaring problem that I just realized is there's no toxicology studies being done by the state on water. And if your water is impacted, it's nice to know what's in there. But sometimes the levels of chemicals are so low, it's very difficult and very expensive to identify them. And a simple toxic assay would be most helpful. And toxicology assays have not been done on water or air. And I'm thrilled that we have attracted New York School of Medicine to our county, and they are beginning to do some toxic assays on the water impacts.
Yeah, this is Deb. Go ahead.
The federal government isn't, EPA isn't doing anything for us here, and neither is our state. We live in a very rural community. There's no zoning, and we fall through the state and federal cracks. And we need to generate the data ourselves or our voices will be lost along with the data that isn't generated. So it's so important for us to get the data and attract science.
Just to add to what Rebecca said, this is Deb Thomas. Many of you have probably heard of the EPA Pavilion investigation on groundwater contamination. That was conducted beginning in 2009, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly. That's been turned over to the state of Wyoming about a year and a half ago. We're still waiting for them to take some action. The EPA came out with a draft report that the water in Pavilion was heavily contaminated. They came to the conclusion that it was from oil and gas development. The state and industry insists that there's no proof of that. And now that study has been turned over to the state, we're really getting nowhere. with the investigation. So those folks are still living in a community with serious groundwater contamination. And now, as you can see from the findings in our air monitoring study, they're also getting creamed by air emissions. So lucky them, huh?
Elizabeth, this is Denny. I'd like to add a point about what the feds are or aren't doing regarding contamination. Yeah, as you probably know, there are wholesale exemptions from the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Resource Recovery Act, and every major national environmental regulation for oil and gas development passed a few years ago under the Bush administration. There's no sound science that supports that whatsoever. However, Earth Justice and 60 other groups, including Global Community Monitor and the groups on the phone, have filed a petition with the U.S. EPA demanding that they regulate the hazardous air pollutants from oil and gas production sites. That petition is moving its way through the bowels of EPA slowly, but we have some optimism that there might be finally some federal action in support of communities in oil and gas development areas before the end of the Obama administration. Thank you.
Thanks, Denny, and Deb and Rebecca. Other questions?
May I ask a question?
Yes, please. If you can just tell us your name and your media organization.
Sure thing. It's Reed Frazier. With the Allegheny Front radio show on public radio in Pittsburgh. I just wondered, maybe it's a question for Denny, but, you know, when these studies come out, their response from the industry is often, you know, negative. And I just was reading comments online on articles already posted about this study, basically saying, how can we trust this study? This the group behind it, your group, is, you know, opposed to fracking. I just wanted to get you to get your response to those kinds of comments about, you know, the sort of neutrality or objectivity or, you know, potential bias from this kind of study. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I would start to say that it wasn't really, we're not really behind the study. What's behind the study is now, over the last few years with oil and gas development, our organization, which empowers people to test the air to find out what they're breathing, has been contacted by hundreds and hundreds of residents seeking to know what they're breathing. We do provide objective, sound science methods that's used by the EPA and all the other agencies in order to gather that data. I would say to the oil industry, rather than hitting us with your usual response, why don't you show us some data from Clark, Wyoming, that shows the air is clean? Why don't you show us the toxic test from Susquehanna? What about Arkansas? I mean, we looked at what the states have done for air studies, and as Rebecca has said about the water stuff, they're totally incomplete. They're not good science. They don't answer the question that we set out to answer with the residents. What are people breathing? The facts of the data stand for themselves. I would challenge the media folks, if you don't believe it, get yourself a Summa canister, get yourself a formaldehyde badge, go out where we took our samples and see what you find. And the study is definitely not biased. Like I said, we found these high levels in 40% of the samples, not 100%. If we wanted to do a biased study like states and industry did, we'd hit 100%, okay? But because we wanted to use sound science to get the real answer, you know, we didn't get 100%. We got what we got, and it's still significant.
Thank you, Denny. And this is Elizabeth. I would just add to that there, and it was mentioned earlier by several of the presenters, there's such a wide range of organizations and community-based groups and residents who really do represent people from all walks of life, from rural communities, suburban, even urban communities facing these challenges. It's not as easy as trying to pinpoint it down to one or two quote-unquote biased organizations. So many folks, including health professionals, small business leaders, et cetera, So I'd like to make that point as well. Deb, was that you wanting to make a point?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Denny was saying. ShellTest does environmental testing as well, and I'd say we get probably 10 requests a week from people all over the country who are concerned about their air quality, their water quality, what they're living with from this industry. It's not like people are looking for something to go out and fight. This industry is horrible to live with. It's not only difficult, it's also extremely dangerous. And this isn't something that people just take on because they don't have anything to do. They're fighting for their lives. You know, fracking not only fractures rock, it fractures whole communities. It fractures people's lives and their health. This is very serious business. It's not a game.
This is Rebecca. If I might just add that after we had done the formaldehyde bag samplings, we had a meeting with a Williams spokesperson, and Williams operates most of the natural gas compressors in our area, and I do believe that all of the badges that we placed around compressors, they were all Williams facilities. And during one of our desk meetings with the Williams spokesperson, she said, you know, we are concerned about the formaldehyde coming off our compressor stations too. I just wanted to note that.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Any additional questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. It's Matthew Leonard here up at WXXI Public Broadcasting in Upstate New York. Just on the role of compressor stations, there's a couple of new facilities in development for the Millennium Pipeline, which is a big natural gas pipeline being expanded across New York State. Including one in Orange County. I'm just wondering if there you have information about any sort of baseline data that is being gathered to, you know, to sort of give you a kind of a baseline for emissions and health before these facilities go into operation. In other words, you know, is this a chance to maybe get in the ground level before a facility is completed and get some useful baseline data on air quality, if you know, if there was monitoring in place before the compressor station actually opened?
Thanks for that question. We do have a response to that. I'm going to ask Denny to answer that question first.
Yeah, thank you for the question. We have been working primarily in Delaware County now, but we're looking elsewhere in New York with the Catskill Mountain Keeper and the Water Keepers Alliance, who are doing baseline water testing there in advance of any possible development in that area. As you know, the moratorium still holds. So, yes, we're collecting baseline data with formaldehyde badges near compressor stations, the citizens are, I should say, and SUMA canisters for volatile organic compounds, and we'll complete a year-long baseline study later this year or early next year. However, I do want to mention that the residents there also took several samples when their compressor station on Hungry Hill, I believe it is, did a what's called a maintenance event called a blowdown. And what a blowdown is there's about 10 miles of pipe full of natural gas between compressor stations. They basically opened up the pipe to the air without any kind of capture, filter, scrubber, anything, and blew 10 miles of natural gas into that community. The samples that we gathered prior to that time were pretty clean, but as soon as they started releasing it, the levels of toxic gases were off the charts. So that's one of the practices that we're talking about that's already affecting the state of New York. We further found a guidance document from the US EPA and the Oil and Gas Association telling compressor operators how to safely and cleanly do it, not to impact their neighbors. That kind of guidance is not being followed in New York and probably elsewhere.
No, this is Rebecca. It's not followed at all in Pennsylvania. There are blowdown preventers, and industry in my county is not using it. And blowdowns also occur system maintenance, as Denny mentioned, but here in the extraction zone, sometimes there's so much pressure in the gathering lines, there's too much pressure coming into the compressor station, so the dehy valve fails, and the dehydrator, and it just vents raw gas into the air and all of the VOCs that the methane conveys also. That happened the first time here in My Hill about 2 years ago, and it vented for 2 hours, and it's loud, it smells like, it sounds like a jet engine, it's scary, and nobody ever tells you what it is.
Thank you both. We also have on the line Hillary Baum with the American Sustainable Business Council, who's calling in from New York, and I wondered, Hillary, if you wanted to add anything just in terms of what New Yorkers are doing and feeling about the hazards associated with that kind of activity.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm here, and we're a business organization that's working towards a sustainable economy. And I think I can generally say that what we're talking about, which includes the further development of fossil fuels, is certainly moving us away from a sustainable economy and away from an economy based on that would be based on green and safe energy. In New York, there's so much happening right now, and there is tremendous concern about the build-out of the infrastructure, as we're discussing right now. So even short of having actual fracking permits being issued, we are definitely feeling the effects from the pipeline installations and the kind of compressor activity that was just described. We are working very hard to hold on to the de facto moratorium that we have, but it points to waiting for the right kind of health impact information. So I think that we're all really talking about the same needs for really good science-based information that's comprehensive and independent before we go forward in any way with any new fracking.
Thank you, Hillary.
Sure.
Other questions from the media? Okay, well, we're very close to the top of the hour, and so I want to thank everyone for your participation today. Thanks for the great questions from reporters and for your attention to everyone on the call today who has shared their experiences in the data in the journal report and the report warning signs. On behalf of Coming Clean, which is an organization with 300 some members representing 200 different organizations all over the country, I'd like to thank Denny Larson and Ruth Reach from Global Community Monitor, Dr. David Carpenter, Director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University at Albany, State University of New York, Emily Lane, who's a community member in Central Arkansas and with the group ArkansasFracking.org, Deb Thomas, who's a study participant living in Clark, Wyoming, and Director of Shale Test, Rebecca Roeder with Breed Easy, Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, and all of our other study participants who participated in this project. I'm Elizabeth Crowe, Associate Director with Coming Clean, and just a reminder that a recording of this teleconference and a link to both the journal article in Environmental Health and the downloadable PDF of our companion report called Warning Signs, Toxic Air Pollution at Oil and Gas Development Sites can be found at www.comingcleaninc.org/warning signs. Thanks again to everyone for joining this teleconference call and for helping to tell these important stories of oil and gas development in the U.S. Please contact Stephanie Hendricks if you would like to get in touch with any of the folks who spoke today, or other participants that we have in each of the six states that participated in the project, as well as many of of our partner and support groups all over the country. Thank you so much, and enjoy the day.